Hello, everybody. Oh, I'm so loud. This is great. My name is Sarah.
I'm Michael.
Harry.
And Kat.
And together we are some of, not all of, the, we couldn't all fit on stage, but the Dreamcat team, and we killed Clippy. You might have seen this around the campsite. We have currently have our latest puzzle hunt running here at camp. It's all about the mystery of who killed Clippy. You have to traverse all of the programs in the computer. And this is actually our third puzzle hunt that we have, big puzzle hunt that we've made. And the first was at EMF 2018. Does anyone remember these things, these sort of Dreamcatcher things? Ooh, they're not showing. I've gone on to slide three. Is there anyone? Great, thanks. Great. Well, we killed Clippy. That was the slide about killing Clippy. This is better now. Cool. So back in 2018, we ran our first puzzle hunt here at EMF called Dreamcatcher. Since then, we did one in 2022 called Octonet. We've done a few other bits and bobs since then, like a podcast and some immersive theatre. But I guess what we really want to get across in this talk is how exciting we find puzzles, the variety of different types of puzzles that we've built, and how try and get you guys really excited about that too. So first off, you know, where do you start? How do you make, this is a bit of a presumptuous question, maybe it should more be like, how do you make it not be absolutely terrible? How do you make it not break, and how do you tie it all together, all these different puzzles? So in order we're going to go, oh yeah, we are going to be talking a bit about this year's hunt, the Clippy puzzle hunt, but don't worry, we are not going to be telling you any hints at all or any answers, so no spoilers. In order then, we're going to go through design, testing, tech, and finally, story. And without further ado, I'll pass over to Michael.
Thank you. Whoa, it is quite loud. I want to tell you about how we approach designing puzzles and how we approach designing puzzle hunts. Firstly, what is a puzzle hunt, in case you haven't done one? We consider it a mixture of escape rooms and treasure trails, so a bunch of puzzles, but spread over a large area. So getting players to explore a region whilst also exploring their brains. They're very fun to build, maybe sometimes more fun to build than to play for some of ours, some of our past attempts, and you don't need prior experience to do it. It's something you can just get going with right now. Puzzles can take any form you want. Paper is a great place to start. You can make physical things, you can make digital things, you can go actor-based if you're really keen. And quite often they have a structure to them, so maybe a narrative, a story, or some kind of meta puzzle at the end that kind of brings it all together to kind of make it cohesive rather than just a smorgasbord of puzzles. If you want to build a puzzle hunt, you've got to build some puzzles. How do you go about doing that? How do you come up with an interesting puzzle that isn't just another cryptic crossword or Sudoku? What we like to do is we like to try and start as far away from puzzles as possible. Just start with things that are inspiring, cool stuff. So we just keep lists and we chat to each other about things that we find interesting. So interesting Wikipedia articles, YouTube videos, scientific or historical facts. And we just think, oh, this is interesting. Can we start from this? If we find something that we think might be puzzle worthy, we then think, okay, what fun things can we get players to do that they don't normally have the opportunity to do, or maybe don't normally have the license to do? How can we get people to just do something interesting, some kind of activity that they wouldn't otherwise be doing? And it's only at that point when we've found something that we think is cool that we actually get the puzzle mechanic in. We kind of actually leave the puzzle mechanic to the end. And quite often the puzzle mechanic will just be something that people are familiar with, maybe a crossword or a cipher or some kind of board game, mobile game. So to kind of give you a worked example of a puzzle that we built in this way, we built this semaphore puzzle for the puzzle hunt in EMF 2022, Octonet. You might have seen some people waving flags at each other. That's our fault. The way we came up with this is this actually started from a Wikipedia article about optical telegraphs. So if you cast your mind back to the 1800s in France, they had a network of optical telegraphs going across the country that were owned and controlled by the government for sending messages. Obviously, they could send messages much faster than by foot or by horse. And what do you do when you have that kind of competitive advantage in information and communication technology? That's right, you use it to gain the stock market and make lots of money. And that's what some enterprising bankers did. They figured, oh, if we can get messages from Paris to Bordeaux quicker than the newspapers, then we can tell our mates how the stock market is going to change before the newspaper delivers the news, and they can make decisions based on that. But how do you do that when the government owns the optical telegraphs? You bribe people, and you get them to introduce errors in the messages they're sending, little harmless typos that then get decoded at the other end and used for wire fraud. And we thought, hey, wire fraud, that's cool. Can we get players to do wire fraud? So we thought, okay, let's try and make a puzzle out of this. Why don't we build optical telegraph towers all over EMF? But unfortunately, we don't have bricklaying skills. That sounds quite big budget. The EMF installations team would have a few questions about that. So we had to start with something a bit simpler. And we thought, okay, what about semaphore? Semaphore is fun, objectively, scientifically. And it's something that people don't normally get to do. People don't normally do semaphore, but everyone's familiar with it, so maybe this would be like a good license for people to just do some semaphore and each other make silly shapes. How do we turn it into a puzzle? For this one, the inspiration just came from that historical fact about people introducing errors into messages for wire fraud. We told players, just send this message. We made it asymmetric, so someone would send a certain message, so salut, and the receiver would get a different message with some errors in, and it would then kind of like self-propagate around, and players would realize that just by sending these messages, something funny is happening, and then there would be a puzzle that I'm not going to go into too much detail about. So in this case, our inspiration was just a cool Wikipedia article. The fun component was getting people to wave flags at each other. And in this case, the puzzle was actually just basically spot the difference. It was a very simple puzzle, but within the kind of framing of physical activity and wire fraud, it actually ended up being one of the more popular puzzles. A lot of people said it was their favorite. When we built it, we play-tested it, people seemed to really enjoy it. So we didn't actually have to change it much. Testing isn't always that smooth, though, and I'm going to pass on to Harry to tell you about how we do testing.
Thanks, Michael. So when we are testing puzzles, there are actually a bunch of different things we're trying to test. So there are the puzzle mechanics, our implementation of those mechanics, the way the players interact with it, which is really important, and most important of all, how the players feel when they're doing it. And what we want to do is test all of these different things and not neglect any of them. It's a bit abstract, so I'm going to talk about an example. And the example is 3D Maze that you might have seen out in the field. We said no spoilers. There aren't going to be spoilers here because I'm mostly talking about what we tested and all the stuff we threw away. So when we first had this idea as the theme, our initial thought was, clearly we can't build a human-sized maze. That's ridiculous. It has to be big enough people could get lost in it, tall enough people couldn't see over it. That sounds really hard. What could be like more less ambitious and more achievable? So we thought, well, what if we put a small maze inside a box and had a camera inside there that you could move around? So Michael prototyped this with a GoPro and a magnet that you could move around from outside the box, and it looked pretty cool, but it was basically just a little bit chonky, and we weren't confident that we could get it to work reliably. So that was a good test of the implementation, and it told us that that probably wasn't a good implementation of this idea. So next, Lewis, who's sitting down there, came up with a version where we had a camera fixed to the ceiling of the maze, and that could move around on runners. And Lewis did a very like minimal prototype of that, which was enough to prove that we thought that implementation would work. It would give us that confidence. But to finish building that implementation would be quite a lot more work, and we didn't want to do all of that work before having a chance to test all of these other aspects. So what Lewis did next was actually build a kind of rough and ready video game version of that implementation of the maze using a game engine called Godot. And that allowed us to test the full implementation of those mechanics. And what we found was that the puzzle mechanics worked, that implementation worked, but when we asked people to actually play it, they just didn't quite get it and what they were supposed to do and how to interact with the puzzle. So we went back to the drawing board entirely, threw everything away, and we said, okay, if we limit the maze to just this small 5x5 grid, maybe that's something we could build more at human scale. And within that constraint, is there an interesting puzzle we can come up with? So we came up with a different puzzle mechanic, and we tested it by just basically giving people the map of the maze on paper and just getting them to walk around it and telling them what they'd see at different points in the maze. So just GMing it and like running it on paper as a really easy, quick prototype. And what we found was that this puzzle mechanic works, and also it worked even though people had a map of the whole maze, they could see the whole thing, they still interacted with it in the way that made sense and made the puzzle work and that they enjoyed. So actually, it didn't matter if the maze was not so tall you couldn't see over it. It didn't matter if you could actually see through the walls of the maze. So what we did for our prototype run last year, we went and bought, literally, I think the day or 2 days before, a bunch of bamboo sticks, the cheapest fabric that money can buy, and we set it up in a field for our prototype run, and we got to play test the maze with real people, and we found that the mechanics worked, this implementation worked, players interact with it how we expected, and they enjoyed it. So that was a great, successful, full test of that puzzle, which is now what is set up in the field over there in a slightly more sturdy and solid version. But apart from that, it's exactly the same puzzle. So what did we learn? Test early and often. And most importantly, make sure you're testing every aspect of the puzzle, the mechanics, the implementation, the way the players interact with it, and the experience they have. Find ways of playtesting without having to build the whole thing, so using computer mock-ups or just really simple paper prototypes to let you get on to testing that interaction and reaction without having to build the full implementation first. And that makes it easier to throw away things that aren't going to work, because the most important thing is to stay open-minded, be prepared to throw away anything and everything and start over again. The guiding star through all of this should be the experience the player's going to have and how they enjoy it. And that brings us on to the question of how hard is too hard. So if people are coming to do a puzzle, they're expecting to have a certain amount of challenge. And there's a few ways. The way you might approach this, if you haven't done it before, is you might think, well, okay, if a puzzle is completely trivial, that's obviously not fun. And it gets a bit more fun as it starts to be more challenging, and there's going to be a point at which it's too hard and people stop having fun because they can't solve it. And if it's completely impossible, that's negative fun because people will be annoyed. So the way you might approach it is to come up with something that seems like a fun puzzle, chuck it out there. If it's a bit too hard, add some hint balloons to make it easier. If it's a bit too easy, maybe throw in some red herrings to drag it back down again. And hopefully end up somewhere in the middle of this chart where it's in that sweet spot of the graph where it's challenging but not too hard. None of this is exactly wrong, but it's a little bit oversimplified. So we could try and apply that same logic to building an amusement park ride. And in that case, the graph would look like this. So if you're experiencing 1G of acceleration, that's what happens when you are just sitting in a chair at home. That's not inherently fun, depends what you're doing. As you experience more acceleration, it gets more exciting and exhilarating. Once you get past about 5G, you start having a bad time. If you get past about 10G, you start having a very bad time and negative fun. If we applied that same logic to amusement park rides, that would tell us that the perfect amusement park ride is a centrifuge that spins you around at a steady 4.5G the whole time, because that's right in the sweet spot of the graph. Obviously, amusement park rides do not all look like this. They are much more varied and interesting. The reason for that is that it's not the acceleration that's fun, it's the ride that's fun, and acceleration is how we experience the shape, the contours, the unique design of the ride. And exactly the same thing applies to puzzles. So you might have parts of your puzzle that are more challenging and parts that are gentler. The important thing is that the players have a satisfying journey through your puzzle, whatever type of puzzle it is. And you want to help them go along that nice, satisfying path. Now, hints can help with this to keep them on the right track, but if you rely too heavily on hints, they can start to feel like they're just following along rather than solving for themselves. It's much better to help them along the way, so giving them like checkpoints. So if there's like intermediate information, so they haven't solved the full puzzle yet, but they've got some answer along the way, they can check that they're on the right track and that they should keep going in that direction. Similarly, if you find through playtesting that there's a path that players go down where they get really stuck and way off off track, think about ways, rather than trying to hint them away from going that direction, can you just make it not an option? Can you just change the design of your puzzle so that's just not a thing that's possible to do? Red herrings can be fun, they can be playful, they can help the player feel like they're solving the puzzle for themselves, but they should be short, shallow diversions rather than like big dead ends that you can get stuck in. And finally, remember, playtesting, because sometimes players will do things that take you completely by surprise, that you were not expecting at all, and will solve your approach to a puzzle in a completely different way to what you anticipated, and you should pay attention to the experience they're having. Is that actually a better path through your puzzle? Should you just cut off some bits of it that are less fun? Should you allow this or actually make this the main path through your puzzle? And with that, I'm going to hand over to Kathleen.
Right, so I'm going to talk a bit about the tech we've used in puzzle hunts past and present. And firstly, why is puzzle making a neat hobby that we totally encourage people to take up? The first reason is it's a great excuse to learn new techs and to make things and to share those things with other people. We're probably not the only people that got a Prusa Mini and printed all the sample models and then didn't really know what to do with it next. Well, puzzles can provide an excuse for doing things. You can we've got Lego in our puzzles. That's obviously a lot of fun to build as Lego ever is. We've got electronics that we've been dabbling in, and we've got 3D printing. And the thing about puzzle making is it's really 10 different hobbies in a trench coat. It's a way, especially for a big team like ours, for everyone to dabble in this or that thing and to bring it all together. But one key point is that you don't need any of that stuff. It can improve your puzzles or it can open new possibilities, but you can very much build it with you can build a puzzle hunt with very basic tech like paper and pens, and then build on top of that as you go along. And to illustrate that, I'll quickly run through all the puzzle hunts we've done for EMF's past. So back in 2018, when we did Dreamcatcher, that was heavily reliant on paper puzzles. And paper puzzles are simple, but they're great. They have a lot of possibilities. We had crosswords. We had lots of other things, and you can do pretty much anything with them. One of the most popular type of puzzles is the puzzle pint thing that happens every month, and that has puzzles being published and by someone somewhere in the world, and then sent around to the organizing teams in every city, and everyone can print them and do them at home. So yeah, paper is tried and tested and great. Likewise, we had handicrafts like the Dreamcatchers we had around the camp. These are fun because they're more interactive. They draw attention and they can feel more tactile or to some extent more real than just paper. And we had various types of AV. We had some VR. We had projectors and sound, and some other gubbins as well. Fast forward to 2022, where we had a whole 4 years to prepare. That was Octonet, and one of the things we brought in was carpentry, specifically the door in the null sector that's still there to this day, which Harry painstakingly built. We brought in interactive escape room type experiences, and the way we've been building those is using Godot, which presumably lots of people are familiar with as a video game engine. As we found out, it works great for building interactive experiences as well, and we've used MQTT, which is a messaging system for sending messages out to the various trinkets and electronics around the room. And we've also integrated with random other things such as phones. And then come this year, we've brought in some things made of Lego, lots of electronics, more or less visible in various puzzles, and last but by no means least, 3D printing, which Wendy, who's in the audience but not on stage, is very much our guru in, and she can get the printers to do things that they were very much not designed to do. And the 3D printing we found has really increased the production values of the puzzles. Some of the things wouldn't have been possible otherwise, some of the things would have been, but having them be 3D printed makes them a lot more tactile and fun and engaging. And what have we learned from all of this? We've learned that you can build a puzzle hunt with very simple tech. Don't be put off if that's what you want to start with. In some cases, pen and paper can be optimal. And new tech ideas can both enhance puzzles you could have built otherwise anyway, but they can also be a way to come up with ideas for new puzzles. So they might open up fun, interactive things you can get the players to do. And on top of those, you build the puzzle mechanics and bring it all together to a fun experience. And I will hand over to Sarah for the storytelling.
Do you want to give him the mic? Cool. No, say mine. I've got this one. Cool. Right. Stories. So I'm probably the wrong person to be doing this because I'm a bit obsessed with stories, like maybe more so than the average player who is interested in puzzles by definition. I'm the kind of person who goes into a video game and reads all the lore before moving on to the next zone. And some people are like, not that. But anyway, so the point is, I guess we want to put stories in our puzzle hunts. I personally find they make the experience a lot more meaningful. They put the player right there in the driving seat. Makes, even if you're doing something that is not directly related to the story, it makes it more impactful. But with that all being said, a story can make your puzzle hunt worse. And I think it's important to sort of deal with that head on and, you know, come up with some ways to, like, combat that. There are three main problems that I think we've found with putting puzzle stories into your puzzle hunt or your escape room or whatever. I've given them some titles. They are skip cutscene syndrome, needle in a haystack syndrome, and 8,000 rainbow gems syndrome. So let's start with skip cutscene syndrome. If anyone hasn't played Assassin's Creed, it's a great game. It has really quite an elaborate story. All of the Assassin's Creed games have a plot. They have, like, characters wanting to murder each other, this, that, the other. And nobody who's ever played an Assassin's Creed game can remember what the story is because the game encourages you to see it as a game about sneaking around and stabbing people and occasionally jumping off tall buildings. So this is not inherently a problem, but I guess it's important to remember that some people only care about gameplay. And if you have a story that gets in the way, that is a source of frustration. So if you're setting out to basically write a book which happens to have a puzzle in it, that's one thing. What we much prefer to do is write some puzzles with a bit of something linking them together. And part of that is because we just really only care about what the player is, how much fun the player is having. We don't care about whether or not they're following the story. The next problem is what I'm going to call needle in a haystack syndrome. I was lucky enough recently to work on an immersive theatre event as a sort of puzzle consultant. It's called the Key of Dreams. It's just over the border into Wales, and it's 24 hours in a spooky, haunted manner. And basically, you know, it was made clear to me when I came on that it had to not feel like an escape room. It has to feel like you're exploring this house. You're in the story, in the movie, or whatever. And the really interesting thing is that this is really obvious in retrospect, but, you know, when we were designing it, it's difficult to remember. The moment players show up in that house and they're told, whoa, this is a really spooky house, there's loads of mysterious things in this house, anything could be a puzzle, they'll believe you. And they'll be picking up the coffee and they'll be being like, is the ingredients of the coffee a puzzle? And there are two problems with that. Number one, everything becomes really difficult for the player. Like, you play test a puzzle on its own and you're like, I'm pretty sure this is a simple puzzle, you only have to do A, B, C. And players invent D, E, F, G all the way through Z because you haven't made it clear to them what the boundaries of the puzzle are. That's problem number one. Problem number two is that it makes everything harder to realistically playtest. This is somewhat a problem with world building, but I think it's also a problem with the story itself that you're telling. You know, we've all read murder mysteries which have loads of red herrings. They're a lot harder to solve because there's other things going on that get in the way of you actually getting to the ending. And I guess the lesson that we've learned from that is that it's really hard to tell complicated stories. Don't bother. That would be our advice. Like, try to keep your stories as simple as possible. There are lots of other benefits to this. It's much easier to avoid plot holes. You're much more likely to bring all of those cutscene skipping players along the ride with you. And so on. And the third one is, oh crikey, the third one is a problem I'll call the 8,000 Rainbow Gem story. I really hope.
Lysandra, I've come for your head!
So you finally made it. Dennis, did you weep when you watched Archibald bleed to death?
You'll pay for what you've done. It's time to finish this once and for all!
I look forward to stomping on your corpse. Ah! You'll have to get more than 8,000 rainbow gems to beat me.
Smooth this here and do a little combo.
Horizontal.
So the punchline to this this video is called something. There we go. Story, gameplay, dissonance in video games. So what have we? Oh, go away.
Lysandra, no. I've come for your head.
That's absolutely predictable. Right. What have we learned? An incongruity. Like, okay, the story they're telling is very flamboyant, and the game they're describing is fairly boring. Neither of those are the problem. The problem is that those two things don't go together, and that incongruity breaks players out of the experience. So the solution that I think most games try to achieve is to make the puzzles diegetic. What does that mean? When you're watching a movie, usually you can hear music, and the characters can't, because it's not actually existing in their world. It's a shorthand for what is going on in their inner lives. And, you know, it's a way of compensating for the fact that you can't be undergoing the same experience as them. In contrast with diegetic music, this is not diegetic. In contrast with that, diegetic music is music that the characters themselves can hear. So instead of compensating for the difference between the character and the viewer or the player, you are erasing it. And that can be very effective. It can sort of really bring you onto the same level as the characters. It can be quite playful. It can be a bit meta. If anyone saw this recent episode of Doctor Who, he made an offhand joke about it. But here's the problem. Diegetic, you're making your puzzles diegetic by analogy, sorry, do it in the right order. Some puzzles and video game experiences are not diegetic. This is a fantastic, fantastic game. It's called Disco Elysium. In this game, it's a bit like D&D. You have skills and you roll dice in order to determine whether you pass skill checks. So it shows you these dice. It's not saying in this game you are actually rolling dice. The character's not rolling dice, but it's a shorthand for what is going on, you know, in the world and that element of randomness. In contrast, you get games like Outer Wilds. It's a fantastic game. All of the puzzles are very tightly integrated with the environment, and they're sort of, you know, with the world, the environment, the things the player is doing is the same as the things the character is doing, because a lot of it's about, you know, you have like a big inventory that you have to manage. It's about learning things about the world. The problem, get to it, is that Outer Wilds gets away with this brilliantly because it's just a very well-designed game. It's really fun to play, but diegetic doesn't actually mean fun. I could make a game or a puzzle hunt about being an archaeologist and decoding the whole Rosetta Stone based on a photo of the Rosetta Stone. But that's going to take like 18 months and require a degree in classics. And that's not fun. I mean, I'm not saying degrees in classics are not fun. I'm just saying that that's a level of investment that is out of whack with the type of experience that we're trying to build. So we haven't actually gotten rid of the rainbow gems. We've just replaced it with a different problem called the 8,000 lines of hieroglyphs. So following what the characters in the story are doing only makes it fun to play if you've sort of started from the point. It's like you're coming at the problem from the wrong direction. And again, you know, I hope we've made this clear. We're really trying to make our puzzles fun to solve. We're not trying to make them super hard. So for me, the most important thing that we've learned that we want to try and share with everybody is that if you start with a really great frame narrative, you start with an excuse to put in whatever stories, whatever puzzles you want, then everything else will follow. A really good example of this for a video game, I think there's a lot of video games that do this, but my favorite one, is Portal. They definitely came up with the portal first, right? They came up with, here are some puzzles to do with the physics of the world. And then they came up with a frame narrative about you being in a testing facility, and that's why they can introduce mechanics one by one. That means that they get the tutorial seamlessly integrated with the rest of the game. You don't feel like you've got your training wheels on. You feel like you're playing the game, but you are objectively doing the tutorial. You're learning the rules. The other really interesting thing that Portal does is that it really pretends quite hard that it doesn't have a story until the story comes and punches you in the face. And that's brilliant, because all those skip cutscene players who don't really care about story have to engage with it. They can't not. You are unable to beat this game unless you engage with the story. So keep the story as simple as possible. Keep it present tense. Keep it things that the players are actually doing right now. Backstory is not story. And start with a compelling frame narrative, and everything else will hopefully fall into place after that. Over to Michael to finish.
Yes, and that's, am I on? Yeah, that's everything we've got. So thank you for listening. We hope we've inspired you to maybe try making some puzzles yourself, doing them on, starting out with pen and paper, simple setting or something. We've got, here's an info dump of things we're not going to talk about, don't worry. But yeah, we'll be at the Q&A tent over there if you want to talk to us about puzzles, escape rooms, because we're addicted to them, or anything like that, just come over and talk to us, or we're at Camp Clippy. But yeah, thank you everyone. Thank you very much.